The Fan on Demand.
Those of us who have had the privilege through being in the media of walking into locker rooms for many, many years certainly can tell all kinds of stories, especially in football locker rooms, of walking in and seeing a candy dish on a table somewhere in a room and understanding that what was in those candy dishes was not candy, but rather bennies, uppers, sideways, downers, who knows what, understanding that trainers and team doctors administered painkillers and God knows what else. And while it was shocking, maybe the first time you went into that room, it became so commonplace you didn't even think twice about it. But it was even worse than that, because there were all kinds of things even more long-term dangerous that were being prescribed to players. This get on the field and play, forget about tomorrow philosophy. Is how legitimate in your mind is this action?
Well, I think this is a pretty legitimate suit, at least, you know, judging off the allegations in the suit, which are pretty consistent with the stories that you hear if you talk to players, former players, people around the game. The reason I say that, you know, you're right. Like, football in particular is a very violent sport. It's going to create a lot of injury, 100% injury rate, a lot of pain. You're going to have the use of anti-inflammatories, painkillers, powerful prescription drugs, and that's an important thing to note, prescription drugs, including and also over-the-counter stuff. But what's the key of the suit is that it wasn't just that players were being given drugs or using drugs. It was that the dispensing of the drugs, the use of the drugs, was reckless. It was negligent. The players were not, they say, were not being informed of the health risks that came with using these drugs. They were being given these drugs in a very dangerous manner. You know, too many of them for too long, too many different drugs mixed together in dangerous ways. And that basically the team doctors, and you know, under the auspices of the teams and the NFL, were doing this all in a manner that wasn't just medically unethical, but potentially and probably illegal. So, and it was systemic on a league-wide basis. You know, not every doctor, not every player, not every team, but this was a pattern. That's what this suit is saying, and if a lot of it is true, and it doesn't ring, you know, overtly false, then there's a huge problem here.
Who is it, Patrick? Obviously, you're talking about medical malpractice in terms of, potentially in terms of team doctors. But who else would be? Who else is complicit? Allegedly complicit in that? You know, are we talking about coaches and general managers and, you know, other people in organizations who understood that this was going on and allowed it to go on?
You know what? That's a great question, and that is the kind of thing that I think you would have to see this suit get into a discovery process to really understand and to figure out. Because, yeah, I mean, at one level, it's ultimately these doctors and trainers who were doing this, who were prescribing and giving out these drugs. But if they were doing it with the tacit acknowledgement, knowledge, and approval of their superiors, then I think, in theory, those people could also potentially be responsible, too. You know, if you're a company doctor and you're doing bad things, but you're doing them for the company, are you solely to blame or the company to blame? I think it's probably a mix of both.
Mm-hmm. I would suspect that virtually all of the audience watching or listening to this program now have seen the movie Any Given Sunday, and I'm not here to suggest by any stretch that movie, I'm endorsing that movie or saying it's a real portrayal of what really happens in professional football. But at the core of that movie, one of the storylines in that movie is of one of these doctors. Who prescribes almost anything and everything in order to keep players on the field, and then that gets into conflict with the coach, and then they wind up with one of their star players who needs to take some kind of painkiller in order to just to be able to perform, and the coach eventually says, all right, but you have to sign a waiver. For those that have seen that movie, is this the real life after effect of what was really going on, and that the portrayal in that movie was in many ways pretty accurate?
Yeah, you know what's funny? I'm a fan of that movie as well. I mean, it's an Oliver Stone movie, so obviously it's very over the top. It's a little overheated.
Right.
It's like the worst case scenario of everything crammed together that could happen to one team in one season in a 2-hour period. But I have to say, it reflected reality. You know, it might be a little bit in hand, might be a little bit Hollywood, but it was based on real things. You know, if you look at the suit, that's kind of what is going on in terms of, you know, the drugs these guys are getting. So they're powerful prescription drugs. Some of them, like the opioid drugs, are highly addictive, you know, Percocet, Vicodin. I mean, I think all of us know outside of football, just in society, we've got a big problem with those drugs being really addictive. You know, people just in all walks of life getting hooked on them.
You have
very
to.
Quickly.
I think you should go through.
We've got other drugs. You know, you're getting surgical anesthetic type drugs, which probably shouldn't be used in a sporting context. You're getting all these, you're getting cocktails with these drugs put together. You're washing them down with beer on a team flight, which is another thing you shouldn't be doing. Like I said, it's kind of astonishing, even by the standards of, well, this is a violent game and people need help physically, it's kind of astonishing that these doctors would be giving these things out in allegedly in such a cavalier fashion.
I was going to say the pharmacology here. You look at that list of drugs, Patrick, and it's not, and you know, people understand that players have taken stimulants and that they obviously take some kind of painkiller and maybe those things are doled out. But there's an unbelievable list here of some very, very heavy stuff that was being, and again, the players, some of the players involved in the loss were named in the lawsuit, you know, Jim McMahon, Richard Dent, Keith Van Horn. So some guys, you know, some pretty familiar names from an era in professional in the National Football League. But, you know, it's an entire pharmacy's worth of dope here, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And by the way, the players in the suit are from like the 1960s through the late 2000s. So we're talking about the last 40 years, the last 50 years of NFL football. We're not talking about just one particular era. You know, some of the drugs have changed, but the pattern, at least according to the suit, has not. And you're right, it is like sort of a whole pharmacopoeia. You've got the really powerful addictive opioids, which, you know, walk fame but have all kinds of side effects beyond addiction. You've got these things called non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, which, like, you know, we all know that it's Advil, drugs like Advil, drugs that are much more powerful than Advil, but they have blood thinning properties that can be very dangerous. They can be very, very bad for your kidneys. And you, like I said, you've got these local anesthetics, which is essentially like injections of painkillers you would take going into or coming out of surgery. Plus, I'm glad you mentioned the uppers at the start of this segment, because another really disturbing thing in this suit that isn't getting a lot of attention is that these players talk about getting basically almost a daily course of uppers in the morning or before games, and then they're getting downers at night to sleep, so they're getting barbiturates, quaaludes, and now it's become Ambien. Again, powerful drugs that you really shouldn't be messing with. And if you think about this, right, even if you're not getting those addictive opioids, if you're a player and day in and day out, or week in and week out, season in and season out, you're being cycled on uppers and downers and uppers and downers and uppers and downers, you're getting turned into a junkie. You're systemically being turned into a junkie. That is a really bad thing to be doing.
Now, Toradol is part of this as well, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, Toradol is the drug, I think, that provides the clearest window to this entire issue. So for people out there that don't know about it, Toradol is one of those non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. It's an operating room drug. It is given after surgery to deal with pain. It's a pretty dangerous drug. You know, a couple of European countries have actually banned it. And it's got on its FDA warning label, it's got a huge list of things that you shouldn't be doing with it. You shouldn't take it more than 5 days in a row. It can cause ulcers, gas, internal bleeding, stomach perforation. It increases your risk of stroke. You're not supposed to use it if you've got a high risk of bleeding. And you're not supposed to use it prophylactically, which means you don't take it before surgery or before trauma. And finally, you're not supposed to take it and take a bunch of other things like Advil, because all those side effects get pronounced. Well, guess what? In football, they were violating all of this stuff. They were taking it with a bunch of other medications. They were taking it prophylactically. They were taking it to go into games and not feel pain, to basically go into games and feel invincible. And they were getting trauma in those games. And, oh, one last thing about Toradol. A lot of research suggests that it may cross the blood-brain barrier and be pro-inflammatory in the brain. And why is that relevant? Well, that's going to increase the chances of bad things happening when you get head trauma and or concussion.
Yeah, okay, I was just going to say.
Terrible drug for football.
Why is this? Why now? We've certainly had a big discussion about head injuries in football, and the league is facing legal challenges on that front. Why is the drug issue coming to the fore now?
It's a really good question. I think there's a couple of reasons. I mean, I think first of all, the concussion losses have sort of emboldened players to actually step forward.
Agreed.
To say, because, football players are conditioned to take pain, suck it up, not complain, personal responsibility. I paid the price I paid. The football players, even if that's not actually what was happening, they're very much conditioned to feel that way. You don't really make it as a football player if you don't either adopt or have that mindset. And they're very proud men. They don't want to be seen like they're in pain or they need help. Again, that's the culture of football. So at first, I think for them to step forward in these concussion suits was hard. But once they saw their brothers and their peers doing that, I think they were emboldened. And I also think what they've learned from the concussion suit, they learned the callousness with which they were actually treated
mm-hmm.
by this league and by these teams. And they also learned, we're not alone. Used to just have small groups of guys who maybe were bitter or upset, didn't like what had happened. But like I said, they either felt like they didn't want to be the only guy stepping forward, or they felt like maybe they were just one of the few. But now they've realized, wow, there's a lot of us, and we can do something about it. So I think that the concussion stuff actually led into this a lot. I also think it's just a matter of age, where a lot of these guys are at the point where they're starting to feel the effects of all this. And whether it's the effects of the side effects of the drugs themselves, or it's the side effect of the drugs allowing you to play with and through injury, thereby causing greater injury that then shows up later, which is what happens with a lot of these orthopedic conditions, bad foot, bad knee. You mentioned Richard Dent. He played a season on a broken foot. Now he has permanent nerve damage in that same foot. I think these guys are getting old enough to where it's really cramping their lives now, and they actually need recourse and need help.
With Patrick Ruby of Sports on Earth, I don't know whether you've contemplated this, but what do you think the defense for the National Football League would be if this action made it to court?
I have thought about that. I think there's a couple of things. I mean, the first defense is going to be the same defense the NFL uses for everything that they would have used in the concussion cases if there wasn't a proposed settlement. That would be preemption. Basically, you say, hey, this is something that falls under our collective bargaining agreement. You can't take this to court and sue us. This has to go to arbitration. Obviously, arbitration in most cases heavily favors employers. So, of course, the NFL will want to be there. And in arbitration, there's no chance of punitive damages. There's no chance of, public relations damage from, horrible discovery. Nothing like that. So that's what they'll try first. If they can't get that to happen, I think that they will focus on the causation argument, and they'll basically say, okay, well, you've got these physical ailments, you've got these problems. Some of these guys have had kidney transplants and renal failure and all sorts of horrible things. And NFL will say, well, we don't know it was these drugs. It could have been a lot of stuff. Can you really blame us? And was it drugs we were taking in college? We didn't know that either. Again, the kind of defense they'd probably use the concussion. In this case, though, I actually think it's going to be much harder for them to defend themselves than even the concussion cases. Because while the science in concussion, is very suggestive, there is uncertainty. And even though the NFL appears to have been, putting out bogus science, which is what they're really getting hung on, the concussion stuff, there is still some wiggle room. Mm-hmm. With these drugs, there is not that wiggle room. These are prescription drugs. They've gone through FDA trials. You don't get to market unless we know a lot about the side effects. And the things that were happening are things that weren't supposed to happen. They're violations of the law. They're potentially criminal. They potentially violate the Controlled Substances Act we have here in America. They also violate medical ethics. They violate the kinds of things that are put out by the American Medical Association and, other medicine governing bodies about what you're supposed to do if you're a doctor, how you're supposed to treat these kinds of things. So I actually think this could be much more difficult for the NFL than the concussion stuff.
I'll tell you what, what comes to mind for me. I think the National Football League may try to separate itself from their team doctors who would have administered either the prescriptions or the drugs directly. saying it would be
very much so. I mean, you could definitely see them trying to throw the doctors under the bus.
Throw the doctors under the bus. Yeah, and say you know, we're not physicians. We trusted our team doctors to make advised medical decisions, and they made bad ones or some bad ones.
I definitely think you could see that. And to get back to Toradol, I'll give you a small example of why I think you could see that. So with Toradol, there was actually a survey done or a study done in the early 2000s, and it basically found out that of 30 teams in the NFL that were surveyed, 28, the players were using this stuff regularly. It was being administered by team doctors. The study raised a bunch of concerns. It said, this really might not be a good idea. We really need to look at this more. 10 years later, it took 10 years for the NFL Physician Society to revisit the issue and finally issue guidelines saying, oh, you know what, you should pretty much follow the FDA warning label instructions on this. But at the end of that, did they ban the practice of Toradol? No. They left it to physician discretion. To me, that suggests it was kind of a retroactive CYA move, a way for the future, if something like this happened and there's a lawsuit, to say exactly what you're suggesting. The teams could turn around and say, wait, we left it to your guys' discretion. If you were doing this, that's on you. You're just a bunch of bad doctors. Now, do I think that will hold up in court? I'm not really sure because, again, if you're a company doctor, and in this case, these are company doctors.
Yeah, and I think there would be some interesting conversations that would come up between those company doctors and the guys, between coaches saying, can you get this guy on the field, between a general manager saying, can you get this guy on the field? I think that gets into some pretty murky territory for the NFL, even if they try and go that route. But
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, my sympathies are entirely with the players. I believe, actually, that the teams were completely negligent in this regard. The team doctors were either instructed or under the, the wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Give them whatever you have to keep them on the field or get them back on the field. And the rest be damned. And I think that was the culture of this sport. I have no doubt in my mind that that was the culture of this sport. But I think there are warts in the argument, and that I'm not 100% convinced that these players can win this action. I think it's winnable, but I think there's going to be some bumps in the road, and the National Football League might very well throw up some very interesting defenses. And this is going to be really intriguing. Patrick, good of you to take time for us today. It's a fascinating story. I doubtless we will be talking about it again, and hopefully you'll join us down the road.
Oh, no, I'd be happy to, and I agree with you. It's going to be very interesting. It could get very ugly, and in some ways, that might be the most leverage that these players have. Is, again, like the concussion suits, does the NFL really want to open the vaults, open the books, go back and do discovery on 40, 50 years of this kind of culture? That's not going to be a good PR look for the league that markets itself as wholesome and all-American, no matter what all the facts actually are.
Thanks a lot for taking time for us. That's Patrick Ruby of Sports on Earth.
It's a heck of a story. You know, these guys were, the more and more you know about what went on behind the scenes in professional football, the more you understand these guys were meat. They were, guys playing, most of them playing without guaranteed contracts, sent out in this incredibly violent and dangerous sport, misled about the danger of the sport in terms of head injuries, and then pumped full of everything that you could find in a hospital operating room to make them, to dull the pain and get them back on the field. It is, it's not like people are going to turn away from football because people like violence and they like violent entertainment and they like the violence in football, but this is like seeing how they make the sausage, understanding what is actually going on. And there's, some of the heroes of your youth are very damaged human beings because of that game they played.
Is our next guest with us? Excellent. The story is about a young man named Derek Gordon, a guard at UMass, the University of Massachusetts, who's gay and wanted to come out on his own terms. He told his parents about his sexual preference. He told his coach and then his teammates, and he had a plan to come out, literally, tell the rest of the world. It didn't quite work out that way. Sid Ziegler of Outsports joins us. Sid, good of you to take time for us. How are you doing?
Yeah, great. Thanks.
Maybe I'll let you pick up the story from there and tell us what happened that kind of circumvented Derek's wishes.
Well, it's complicated. As I told the producer, I really don't want to talk about the specifics of the story. It's the Deadspin article explained a couple of basic things that he wanted to come out and publicly, and another organization got wind of it and sent emails to some of his fellow students and coaches and administrators at his school and kind of told them that he was going to be that a basketball player at UMass was gay and was going to be coming out, and created kind of a buzz around campus that Derek didn't really want before he came out publicly. And so it just ultimately, I think he came out at the time that he wanted to. It just was a little more complicated.
Sid, I guess, well, to step back from it then, Michael Sam, the Michael Sam story was managed in a certain way, and to the side of, it worked for Michael Sam. It worked for everybody involved. It was well thought through and well thought out. And there's going to be more Michael Sam stories. There are going to be more stories like this. And I guess at some point they will be ordinary, but they're going to be extraordinary for quite a while. Is there an issue, or is there a protocol, for these stories? Is there, and should there be a protocol for how, because of they are so personal, and because that process is so, is so much an individual's own choice, should there be a protocol for how these stories are handled?
Yeah, it's pretty basic. I mean, at OutSports, we've written about probably 200 athletes over the last 15 years, and we follow the same structure. The athlete contacts you, or you contact an athlete, and you ask them what they want, what they want to do, what are their goals in talking publicly, what are their goals in telling their team, do they want to write the story themselves, who do they want to write it, what parts of the story do they want to tell, and it's always up to the athlete. The athlete, or anybody, owns their own coming out story. That it's up to them. They're the people who are going to have to live through it. And sadly, with Derek Gordon, Athlete Ally, another organization, put their own desire ahead of what the athlete was doing, and just kind of marched forward and did their own thing. And unfortunately, some of Derek's own campus found out that there was a gay athlete coming out in a process that Derek didn't want. So
I guess I'm trying to dance between being basic, as you said, and too specific. So somewhere in between here, what there appears to have been was almost a competition for this guy's story, to own this guy's story.
So that's not, I mean, yes, I understand that might be how it looks, and certainly I think that one organization was in competition with everyone else, but frankly, the people who were working with Derek were the You Can Play Project through Wade Davis and Patrick Burke, mm-hmm. the University of Massachusetts, their athletic department, the head coach of the basketball team, the athletes on the team, ESPN through Kate Fagan, OutSports, and a couple other organizations. No one owned this story. No one tried to own this story. Even in the media, we encouraged him to come out on two different outlets. I suppose I could have, really tried to demand that he only come out on OutSports. And Derek and I had become friends at that point. But that's not the best interest of the athlete. So there was no media entity or organization who owned or tried to own his story. But unfortunately, another organization didn't have anything to do with it, and that was I believe that they were driven by needing to be a part of it, and so they started sending emails to people and asking them to be a part of their own organization and not a part of Derek's story. What's interesting about it is that the University of Massachusetts Athlete Ally organization has now disassociated themselves with that organization, because people understand the importance of athletes being able to tell their own story in their own time and in their own way, and not have an organization try to own them.
And I know it's not, again, not media competing with the story, because it's an advocacy, a self-styled advocacy organization, or an ad, you know, that's what it is, I guess. But, you know, it almost seemed, again, I don't know where you want to go on this one, actually, said, but I'll do my best. It seems like there's the development in that sense of almost a, you know, the coming out athlete industry. You know, like we're going to, you know, see my organization, look at this organization I have formed. I'm going to get attention for it because on the back of this guy who's about to come out.
I think that the LGBT Sports Coalition is a conglomeration of about 30 individuals and organizations working to end anti-LGBT bias in sports. All of those organizations, you know, really put the athlete first, and we work together. And I haven't seen anybody in that group try to own a story. I know that without sports, every time we have an athlete come to us and want to tell their story, the first or second thing I do after talking with them is connect them with another organization, like to help them, because we don't have all the answers. And that's how the coalition works. That's how most of the LGBT sports movement works. It's amazing. We're working together. Unfortunately, Athlete Ally was asked to resign from that coalition because they don't operate the same way.
Who are Athlete Ally? How about that?
It's an organization that's a good question.
It's a guy, right?
Well, is it an actual organization, or is it one guy?
It's an organization that was founded by an individual, the organization says it's there to recruit straight allies in the sports world. That's what they say they do.
Okay.
To get straight athletes to accept, understand, support
gay
athletes?
Yes. That's what they say they try to do.
Do they have, and you'll forgive us, but I have no experience, never heard of them before. Obviously, you have. Have they had any level of success in doing so? Do they have a track record?
What they've mostly done is find athletes who and people in sports who have already offered their support for LGBT athletes, and then they recruit them as their quote-unquote ambassadors, so that every time they appear in the media, they now appear as, you know, for example, Chris Cluey, Athlete Ally Ambassador, or Brendan Iambadejo, Athlete Ally Ambassador. And they have also brought some new voices into the fold as well.
I'm trying to get at motivation other than, you know, ego and recognition. Is there a monetary advantage or incentive for an organization like this to conduct themselves in the way they did in the Derek Gordon situation?
Well, all these nonprofit organizations rely on donations and funding from larger organizations that offer grants. And I think that...
So publicity could be a currency in achieving that objective.
You know, the more people you're able to get to your fundraisers, the more money you make.
Well, okay. So I think you, in essence, answered the question. You were involved... You've acknowledged now that you were involved in Derek's contemplation of coming out or preparation for coming out. You were also involved with Michael Sam. Am I wrong in that, or is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
So you've been a go-to guy in terms of athletes coming out, and you know you've been on this program on numerous occasions. We are not the least bit surprised that that is the case. Is there personal jealousy involved here, in your opinion?
On my part, am I jealous of
no,
people?
No. Were they jealous of you?
Well, you know, I've never. It's funny. You know, I've always believed that the more we're able to work together in the LGBT sports world, the more we reflect sports, and the more we use the tenets of sports to succeed. You can't succeed in any sport without a team and without working with a team. Even if you're a track and field athlete, you need a team around you to help you train. And I believe, from what I've been told from people, is that I'm a very good team player, is that I try to lift up the voices of other people. We just had, you know, earlier this week, we had the story of a lesbian who was a lesbian athlete who was beaten by a bunch of men in Texas. And, you know, I another organization brought that story to us, and I put their logo on the story. I put links to them on the story. I try to lift them up even as, you know, we tell the story of one of their members. So I think it's all about teamwork. When you play like a good teammate, people rally around you. And I haven't heard much criticism of myself. I am proud to say that I'm not a good team member. I think that's the biggest problem with that organization, is that they're viewed as not a very good team member.
Right. Before we let you go, have you talked to Derek since the story went public, and how is he dealing with it?
Yeah, I've been texting within the last 2 days, but we haven't talked about it at all. So I think that this is it's kind of an inside baseball thing, and you know, Derek doesn't, I don't think, you know, he wasn't happy when this was happening. I know that. I think he's just kind of, at this point, on his very short summer break, because he'll be back training very soon. And I don't even know if he's read the story. Somebody must have told him about it, but he hasn't mentioned it to me.
Another twist.
It's confusing. It's a very hard to understand all this. But, yeah, you know, at the end of the day, I think that it comes down to teamwork. Are you a good teammate? Or are you not? And everything we do in life.
Sid, always good of you to talk to us. We thank you very much, and we'll talk to you down the road, I'm sure.
All right, thanks a lot.
Sid Ziegler of Outsports.
Well,
you know, you shouldn't be. None of us should be surprised. I don't think any of us really, if you think about it, are surprised that there will invariably be people who will purport to do good things, but at some point in time, either deliberately or otherwise, will step over acceptable bounds.
And this is, somebody kind of appropriated this, you know, is what happened. I guess it was kind of cryptic there, because there are things he didn't want to say, and I don't think he wanted to talk specifically. But, you know, what happened is that, you know, at this organization that he's talking about, which is formed by a straight guy who is, you know, the idea is that straight athletes who would support LGBT athletes kind of jumped to the forefront in the middle of this story and said, you know, this is going to happen. You know, it's you're going to get attention. If an athlete's coming out now, you're going to get a lot of attention. It's a big deal. The Michael Sam story, biggest sports story of the year in a lot of ways. And people are going to, you know, sometimes exploit and use these situations and people's, you know, somebody's life for their own aggrandizement and their own purpose.
But as I said, you know, to Sid, you know, I am not familiar with any of the athletes that have come out, all of whom have gone through Sid Ziegler and Outsports. Through a consultation process, I have never seen a story where headlined Outsports announces
No, you're right about that.
And these guys did that, essentially.
Yeah, because
they took ownership of a story like they were
to put them on the
in
map.
Competition in the media.
Yeah, no, it's like the industry, it's like an industry, and you're, you know, competing for the, you know, we're gonna be the guys who put our stamp on this guy coming out. So it's a bit unseemly, to say the least, when you're talking about somebody's life, right? And it's not someday it'll be an easy thing. It's not an easy thing right now.
The break. We'll come back with more. Primetime continues on the Sportsnet radio and television networks.
Prizes like no other. From a club like no other. The Fan Club. Log on to sportsnet590.ca.
Before I turn the show over to you, just a couple of quick thoughts on Sid Ziegler and the Derek Gordon situation. You know, for years we talked about athletes coming out in general, and specifically active athletes coming out. And we opined that, you know, it would start with one, and then it would be much easier for the second. And then eventually, we didn't know how long it was going to take, but eventually we'd get to the point where it would be it would be a regular occurrence. And simultaneously, we knew that the first one was going to be a huge story, The second one would be much less. And you'd get to the point where you'd go from a big national story to a big regional story to a big local story, and eventually to virtually no story at all.
Mm-hmm.
It is extremely disappointing, although not surprising, that it's still a story, and that somebody using the platform of being an advocate for athletes coming out and assisting in the process chooses to try and gain some self-gratification or notoriety as a result of it.
Yeah, I suppose it's human nature, and I suppose it's the nature of the world. But
sure,
it's
something we never contemplated, though, I must tell you.
Yeah.
But you're right. Are we surprised? No, not really. Kind of competition is inherent in everything, huh?
Yeah. Well, and seeking, seeking the spotlight, seeking glory, and seeking your personal enrichment or whatever. That's people are going to exploit just about anything, and including this. So this, there will be more of these stories.
And, conversely, what's interesting too is, we always thought there'd be one would come out, then there'd be a second, then there would be a trickle. Then there'd be a stream, and then we'd get to the flood. And by the time we got to the flood, you and I wouldn't be talking about it anymore, and neither would anybody else. It'd just be, okay.
Well, it'll just be part of someone's biography is what it'll be. Or
not. I've envisioned the day where guys wouldn't even hold a news conference to announce it.
No, but it'll mean if you go out and do a profile of somebody, and your favorite player, and you'll meet their significant other during that profile, and it'll be whoever. That's the world we're headed towards, where, when Michael Sam gets drafted and kisses his boyfriend, that's his significant other. We understand that kind of approach to sport. We know who people's girlfriends are or boyfriends are. It'll be just part of that story.
Yeah.
So that's coming.
This is a twist I should have expected, but never even thought about. Yeah. Anyway, over to you.
We haven't got much time, but
we got 5 minutes.
I'll tell you, we've done two football stories this week, and I think it's interesting to kind of think of the two of them together. On one hand, yesterday we had the Canadian Football League with the commissioner of the Canadian Football League and the head of the union, but the commissioner coming on here saying, we got all this money that's coming into this league, but we got to think holistically. We got to think about putting money into this is a league where guys make not a lot of dough, right? They make not a lot of money. They make real people money. They make the same kind of money people make in normal jobs.
The superstar highest paid quarterbacks are in the $400,000
range. Yeah, and there are guys, and the minimum is 60 grand or something
50.
Like that. 50 grand. So,
or it might be less than that. No,
so
it's 50
now. So we can have this kind of economic discussion about, whether teams should be able to, owners should be able to hold on to more of that money or whether they should compensate these guys. And I think, which kind of makes it seem abstract what these guys do for a living. And I'm not saying that the CFL pump guys full of painkillers and narcotics and amphetamines and in order to keep them on the field and then send them out there playing.
Good idea that you don't suggest that.
But, they did send guys out on the field without guaranteed contracts to play during very short careers during which they were modestly compensated to play an incredibly dangerous game that generally leaves the people who played it worse off afterwards than they were before they started. I like football. I like the contact in football. I like violence in sport. I enjoy contact sport, but it is every once in a while you have to kind of pull back and say these are the consequences. And I just wonder if you think about those two things this week. Whether guys in the CFL should get a little bit of extra dough from all that TV money that came in, and then this little this window that opens on what that business looks like. How that sausage gets made.
Well, I mean, I think what everybody recognizes is that whatever is happening today in sport, what happened 20, 30, 40 years ago, not just in football, but in all other sports, was something that was akin to complete and total servitude. And even if you thought that was the case before, we're now getting the window opened into the realities and specifics of that servitude and how it worked. Guys being paid the least you could possibly pay them, being pressured, cajoled, threatened into signing contracts, agreeing to terms, and now maybe even taking drugs in order to continue to play, being lied to, at the very least, not informed. And the issue I have, too, and this is why I brought this up with Patrick earlier, is I wonder if we're going to get into a definition of who did the telling and who was responsible for that. Are teams ultimately responsible for the messages and the actions of licensed medical people? And I'm not saying they aren't or they shouldn't be, but I wonder whether that's not where this story ultimately goes.
Well, that'll be part of it. But, you know, even if it's, let's say it was just a bunch of doctors, you know, just a bunch of doctors working for a bunch of teams. You know, the Hippocratic Oath, first do no harm. You know, there is an ethical responsibility for a physician.
Of course there is.
Now, if you can
imagine. But wait a sec, does that, if I'm the owner of the football team, well, I don't know anything about medicine. He prescribed the drug.
You can imagine that. You can imagine that within the context of a football team, the team doctor had no conversations with the coaches and with the general managers about how the players were dealt with and that those guys had absolutely no knowledge of what these guys were talking, where we're taking. They never said, can you get that guy back out on the field? I can't imagine that.
Well, but isn't it? I mean, don't you think it's the three monkeys? Like, hear no evil, speak no evil?
I think it's
way. See no evil?
I think it's way more direct
than
that.
Don't you think there's a wink, wink, nudge, nudge there?
I think it's beyond that. I think there's some pretty direct knowledge of what guys were taking. I think if you were within a football culture, you knew what guys were taking.
I wasn't in a football culture, and I knew some of the things guys were taking because they were sitting right there.
Yeah.
Nobody was hiding it.
I don't think this is just a bunch of bad doctors. Let's put it that way. There were a bunch of bad doctors, but they're working for somebody.
They knew what the deal was, whether they were told or otherwise. So who's more responsible? The doctor who actually carried it out and didn't stand up and say, screw you, I'm not doing that. Or the owners, who maybe demanded that their doctors do that in order to keep their jobs. Lots of interesting questions. We got to get out of here. Thanks a lot for watching. Blue Jays up 7-2, by the way. Haven't missed a thing. Good night from Toronto.